Welcome to Idle Red Hands Weekly. I'm Jeremy.
I'm Chris.
And what is Idle Red Hands Weekly? The dead speak. The galaxy has heard a mysterious broadcast, a threat of revenge in the sinister voice of the late Emperor Palpatine. General Leia Organa dispatches secret agents to gather intelligence while Rey, the last hope of the Jedi, trains for battle against the diabolical First Order. Meanwhile, Supreme Leader Kylo Ren rages in search of the Phantom Emperor, determined to destroy any threat to his power.
That's the crawl for Rise of Skywalker.
That is the odd, poorly written crawl, yeah, that begins Rise of Skywalker. And it's funny because it seems like they wanted to do the Clone Wars tone of that old kind of 40s serial where they say something very wacky and with an exclamation point at the beginning. So the dead speak. I bring this all up because kind of going full circle, Alan was with us when we did The Force Awakens.
Okay.
And so he came back because he and I saw Rise of Skywalker together.
I know Alan's a big Star Wars fan.
Yes. Yeah. And so he had the enthusiasm that got me through it. So I think otherwise.
Well, that is both a compliment to Alan, because Alan does have a lot of enthusiasm for the things he likes, and a criticism of the movie, which I'll get out of the way now. I kind of have no interest in seeing.
But it's not necessary. I mean, I really think they did a half-assed job of just kind of wrapping stuff up, and it's really odd. But the funny thing, and we talked a little bit about it on the cast, but the funny thing is that we've gotten alternate versions already of this third movie. So Alan Dean Foster.
Oh, you mean like a leaked script?
Yeah, leaked script. So Alan Dean Foster first was all, I don't know why he was angry or whatever, that nobody listens to his ideas or whatever. But he released his version, his treatment of what would be the final. He does all the novelizations.
That's why I recognize the name.
Yeah. Right. In his version, Rey is a robot, because that's why she's so good at everything.
Not liking that, but okay.
That's his big reveal. And then the Colin Trevorrow script supposedly released. Everyone's kind of confirming that, but nobody's saying like who it came from or how they got their hands on it. And he doesn't have the Emperor in his, but there's a lot of similar beats to what they did in this final movie. And I think that's why he received screenwriting credit.
But maybe just better to say, I've read that's why you kind of shouldn't send pitches to Hollywood, because then you know people can claim copyright infringement even if it didn't open.
Right.
Yeah. But or if they didn't open the package. But
yes.
Just knowing, hey, there's a lot of similarities here, let's just give them screenwriting credit to prevent any kind of complaints.
Yeah, and it sounds like the dispute came up because what happened in Last Jedi derailed a lot of stuff, and then the death of Carrie Fisher as well derailed a lot of stuff that was in his script and stuff that I don't think they could have worked around.
Okay, that makes sense, yeah.
Both of those alternative versions are just, and you know, and the final...
Well, that, which from what I hear, is a step up from the actual Rise of Skywalker movie. Right. So
yeah, because I got the screenwriter from Batman versus Superman, Justice League. And he is basically, I think what he's a specialist in Hollywood is they show him a bunch of disconnected storyboards.
Okay.
And then he just like connects the dots in these like random nonsensical ways. He just kind of, you know, when they have things, okay, we've already shot this, so we have to use this scene. So how do we go from here to here? It's like, let me see. Because his brilliant idea was Superman and Batman's mothers have the first name. So that's the common ground that they realize they shouldn't be killing each other.
Okay. I mean, you know what? I mean, honestly, there are no bad ideas, right? If you want to be charitable, there's just poor execution. Right, so like maybe that could have been the foundation for something if well done, which obviously it wasn't. But I mean, that's
people lean pretty heavy on him because Justice League was just a mess. It had like two different versions that were kind of being stitched together and then reshoots that they had to put on top. And he just kind of connects that all together. And I think Hollywood likes that because it's damage control for their kind of nonsense, their management nonsense.
They kind of have to do that. And we were discussing earlier where maybe they just wanted to get number three, this last one, out the door.
Yeah.
And I think Disney could do it, because I've tried to mute stuff because I just don't care anymore. Mm-hmm. But my Twitter timeline is still full of Star Wars this and Star Wars that, and I'm past caring. I think there's enough goodwill and enough, obviously, rabid fans that regardless of what this last movie was, it still would have made a decent amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they just kind of, as you said, maybe just wanted to finish it up so they can move on to other stuff and, you know, kind of bookend this trilogy.
The thing that I think is a real tragedy about this is they took a crossover, huge international hit and a property and tried to reproduce that kind of situation in this very splintered, very niche world and realize, you can't do that anymore. There's nothing that has that kind of mass appeal.
Okay, so you're saying they kind of tried to please everybody and in effect are pleasing nobody.
Right, yeah, because and they basically like, you know, the fan base is like broken in half. So whichever way they go, if they go somewhere new, oh, that sucks. It's not right, Star right. Wars. If they go somewhere old, what are you just repeating right. the same old thing? Right. So it's a no-win situation. So they're just going to have to distill that
Pick
Star Wars fan, and, yeah, yeah, fan base down to what this is going to be. And I don't know if they're going to do it. The way they were doing it, like 5 movies in 5 years was pretty insane. Mm. The pace that, you know, because I think from between Last Jedi and Solo was like 6 months. It was like such a quick.
Oh,
like
wow.
Another Star Wars movie?
I am getting kind of burned out on it, but anyway.
Yeah. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. But yeah, that review is coming up and there's some good stuff. Yeah, there's some good. And Alan gives us some good deep dive geek stuff with Star Wars lore. So that's something to listen for. But yeah, there's not much to say, though. That's the sad thing. It's
well, like, if Alan's there, you're going to be wrong. Yeah. So listen to that for Alan specifically.
Yeah. Yes, yes. What have you been up to?
Apart from getting over norovirus, is not fun at all, especially when you have a toddler and then a partner who catches it later on.
Yeah, right. That
was just, my weekend last week was just done. Mm. Turns out I am kind of last minute going to be running an Aliens game this Sunday, so in about 2 days.
Excellent.
The monthly Osaka Jig meetup. Mm-hmm. A lot of people ended up on the wait list, mm-hmm. and so the facilitator said, how about we split it into two, and that way everybody can play. And said, okay, well, sure. I was going to play Hearts of Wulin, mm-hmm. which is what? Chinese kind of wuxia drama stuff. But yeah, I'll gladly run Alien because one of the people hadn't had a chance to play it. So that's kind of sudden. I can recycle all the props I made for previous games. Good timing because I just finished watching Alien 4, mm-hmm. which didn't realize that was written by Joss Whedon.
Yeah.
But it makes sense now because it's bottom four of mm-hmm. the original. Mm-hmm. I mean, Prometheus is well down there. Haven't watched Covenant yet. But I think the thing that really differentiated it for me was the jokes, quips, and one-liners in the first three movies feel like natural reactions the characters are doing given the tense situation they're in. They're kind of like blowing off steam and, right. and trying to, you know, I mean, that classic game over line.
Right.
In Alien Resurrection, the jokey stuff felt like it was for the audience, which kind of gave it a goofy-ish tone that I didn't really care for.
And also the director, yeah, is a little, like, I think likes that. I think that was the French director, yeah. The sensibility and the sense of humor was a little odd. And some of the actors, some of the casting decisions are a little odd. But they did say that that crew from Alien Resurrection was kind of his prototype for Firefly.
That's what a lot of people said on Twitter, and I see that now. Mm. And someone else had a really good point. I'm like, oh, this is written by Joss Whedon. And they're like, yeah, of course it is, because it's about a strong woman who gets that way by being abused by men. Oh, crap, you're right. Yeah. And...
Right. There's a pattern there.
Yeah, there, yeah. Mm, yeah, there's a real pattern. So that's pretty much all I did tomorrow and Sunday, getting stuff ready for the Alien game, but not much to do.
Cool.
How about yourself?
I was playing some Metro 2033, the first version, the first game. I guess it was upgraded for, it was a PS3, PlayStation 3 game that was upgraded. Originally, I think more people played it on PC, but I was just playing it on the console. That's a great setting. It's based on a novel.
Okay.
That was written by a guy that his inspiration was when he heard it as a child, the Moscow underground, the Moscow metro, the subway, was actually specifically designed to be a bomb shelter. They dug deeper than they needed to do. It has doors that seal off from the outside. Okay. It like sparked his imagination. And like all through his university years, he was thinking about, you know, what is a post-apocalyptic world going to be like if the survivors, the only people that do survive are the people that come from those tunnels. Like you basically grew up in those tunnels and what kind of cultures would evolve. So he wrote that book during that university time, like in his teens, like late teens, early 20s, and couldn't get anybody to publish it and then just put it online. So he just released it for free. Yeah, built a website, put it online, and then it started to develop a following, and then a game developer noticed it, and that's why there's a game setting. So there's three games based on that now. As I was really enjoying the game and the setting, I realized the kind of survival mechanics of the Year Zero engine, you know, Mutant Year Zero, or even Forbidden Lands, the survival mechanic and the consumables, I think, would work really well, and there's a spiritual kind of thing, like the ghosts of the people that had died and kind of the conflicts exist in this world as well. So there could even be like a magic system or a spiritual kind of quality to that. I was thinking how wonderful that as a one shot would be, because it's a really dirty, ugly, and you know, all the NPCs are just going to be miserable people that are just going to make your life miserable, you know, just using a map of the Moscow subway system and then deciding what each of the stations were. The game kind of fleshes some of that out, but there's a lot there and there's a lot to play around with.
That sounds really cool, mm-hmm. and I would definitely play in that game. Thinking of something Alan said at the end of the Hope's Last Day game mm-hmm. played, he said he'd been playing in a lot of kind of games that end unhappily.
Mm.
I wonder if, like, for a one shot, sure, that sounds fantastic. For like longer style play, I wonder if there would have to be mechanics or at least a theme to rebuild things and make things better.
I was thinking about that.
Okay. Yep.
And yeah, because the game itself doesn't. The game itself is pretty right. depressive yeah, yeah. and dark, and you're just, you know, trying to do things in kind of in honor of people that have died along okay. the way. So I went back and watched Tarkovsky's Stalker.
Okay.
I've never seen that. And that's a film that I've watched. It's amazing. It's a film that I watch, and it's probably the reason he didn't live so long, because they used the old Eastern European kind of refineries and abandoned factories. So they were crawling through all kinds of sludge and things. Yeah, and it's made beautiful imagery on the film. But as far as like what the actors had to go through, it was amazing, because there's just things floating on the water. You're like, what is that? What is that?
That's not a prop. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
But there's a concept in there, there's an idea in there that I really like, and I'm not sure if I can get the two things to match very well, but the idea of the stalker is a person that knows the zone.
Okay.
And a zone is this area that they're not quite sure the origin of it, but it's green. And it still contains the, you know, the remnants of these old factories and things that exist, but in the zone is a room, and the room can give you what you wish for, what you want.
Okay.
Yeah, so it has this kind of metaphysical, kind of spiritual element. And the thing that I like about it is the characters are not called by name. They're called by either their job or what they aspire to be. So one's writer, one's professor, and the other is stalker. And so I think instead of naming characters, you kind of give them their
role
and what you want them, you know, like doctor or, you know, hunter. So it keeps it on that weird level. And you just kind of, you're working together because you want to get to this place. So, you know, using the tunnels to navigate to then the outside and then through the zone. And that there could be really crazy mechanics for navigating in the zone, because there's just a really nice idea of it's just one big trap and it's constantly changing. So I think as a dungeon, that could be very interesting. So we could go from, you know, from tunnels to above ground, an above ground dungeon.
But it becomes a hex crawler.
But I think with a combination of a couple of different, like a spiritual mechanic and also kind of a moral mechanic, the things that you've done to help each other or to be good will give you a different ending.
Interesting.
So,
okay.
Yeah. So what I was thinking is if the characters do find that room, they're given the reward based on what they did. And so I think, there could be something really fun there. But it's really inspiring. I think that setting was really fun to play in. And then watching the Tarkovsky movie, I'm like, there is something here. And it's not just let's shoot everything and shoot each other and, you know, win. But the one odd thing about the game is, so the communists come back. And so the one main line is called the Red Line, because it's controlled by the communists. But also there are Nazis. There are Russian Nazis in the storyline. I'm like, how does that work? I don't think any Russian, because they're speaking Russian, I don't think any Russian citizen would become a Nazi. I mean, they wanted that opposition and that kind of cold, you know, the World War II kind of era clash. But I think it would have been better to put
something else.
Something else, yeah, because I don't think any Russian would become a Nazi after what the Nazis did in Russia.
Good point. But I mean, like Nazis are, I thought at one point, were automatic bad guys. You know, where like everyone kind of like, it's kind of, in a video game, it's kind of like, okay, to kill these people. And
yeah, I think that was the idea, is to make it more acceptable. But that's something I definitely wouldn't want to do. I mean, I think you could have communism rise again, but, you know, post-war, but I don't think there'd be national socialism.
Yeah. You say that now, but I mean,
well, anyway. Unless Americans are.
Yeah. Right. Moving on from politics. I mean, what you said about kind of the end result or the room giving you a reward based on kind of essentially like your morality or what you did. That kind of reminds me a little bit of something at the end of Bluebeard's Bride, where throughout that game, as you progress, you decide whether or not Bluebeard is doing something duplicitous or whether you're going to be like a faithful wife, and you get a token flipped to one side or the other. And then at the end of the game, you count up how many I think it's faithful or unfaithful tokens you have. And then that determines what happens to the bride at the end of that game.
Right.
I think this would just be like a more personal level. And you could even do different triggers for the type of character. Here's a general morality one, because we all have a kind of a shared morality. Mm-hmm. But these are kind of personal actions that either get you a, I don't know what you would call that resource, like a hope token or whatever.
Right,
or
something,
not.
Yeah, yeah.
So. Yeah, so that's working pretty well.
Yeah, I thought that would be fun. And I think I was specifically had that same kind of idea. It's like, these alien games have been ending pretty rough.
Yeah, they have. Yeah.
So, what about a survival, but a survival with a reward, like something that you felt, that there was something that happened. That could be also part of something that happened in character creation. You could kind of create, like, what is your cause? Like, who are you doing this for? And then that will be, that will be part of the reward or how that reward works.
Yeah, that would be good. Play that. That also kind of reminds me, I finished season 2 of Lost in Space. And the link there was, my feeling is that the theme of Lost in Space is hope. Mm-hmm. I talked before about how I thought it would make a great RPG, specifically when you're going against the natural disasters, as opposed to like an antagonist you can fight, shoot, or punch. So kind of what you said about going through the tunnels and not having to shoot everybody up, just kind of trying to get somewhere. I didn't like how season 2 ended.
Oh, really?
Like, I rank season 1 of the new Lost in Space over season 2 because it's more of the Robinsons are working together as a team, kind of despite their differences with their different skills, to overcome these natural disasters. And nobody dies. Mm-hmm. People do get, sorry, spoilers. Nobody dies. People do get seriously injured. But at one point I said, I'm okay with that because that's not what the show is about. The show is about hope, and killing people like Game of Thrones or Walking Dead style ends that person's story, and that's not the story the show is telling.
Right.
Season 2 had that, like the kind of against the natural disasters, but it felt a bit too Battlestar Galactica-y for me, where a lot of the episodes or a lot of the plot was going against these kind of sentient antagonists, and I kind of didn't want that. Yeah. So I'm still, okay, let's see what happens with season 3, if there's going to be one. Also, spoilers, it ends with the Robinsons separated.
Oh.
Which I'm also not into because I want it to be the Robinsons together lost in space.
Right.
Not, hey, everybody's lost in space at different points.
Right. Meanwhile.
So, meanwhile over here. So, yeah.
Yes, I'll have to see that. I'm very interested in what they did. But that reminded me, so being inspired and thinking about this one shot made me think about kind of the thing that's going on now and how Wizards of the Coast is feeding the beast with Dungeons and Dragons by releasing, source books and settings and things.
Nobody saw my slowly close my eyes in pain because it's not video, it's radio. Anyway, continue. Right. Sorry.
But that made me think about what's fun and creative about role-playing games, and it's not buying a source book. It's not, getting someone else's version, someone else's adventure. It's being inspired by popular culture and trying to figure out how you would structure an adventure in that. And I think that's the thing that the original Dungeons and Dragons really did and wanted you to do, is like, make this world for you. Like, there's modules, modules, but most of the time you're going to go off of this. I mean, you can use this as inspiration or a starting point or a hook into something that you want to do that pleases the table. So recently, like, the Critical Role World is now the latest book that they're
releasing.
Don't
know what it's called. Yeah.
Who wants to? Like, I mean,
apparently a lot. Apparently a lot, because hey, you're making me break my New Year's resolution about not talking about Dungeons and Dragons. But apparently, I saw something where that is the most pre-ordered source book in recent
depressing
time. And I did kind of think it was depressing. So I mean, like, not shaming people for liking Critical Role, like what you like, whatever. I just thought it was a bit depressing, where, not to get into a whole thing, but it's kind of like, let's have some other creatives work on this rather than giving it to the thing that seems to be the most popular. However, I understand that Wizards of the Coast and Hasbro are companies and they need to make they want to make money. So doing that lined their pockets like nobody's business. So congratulations, you succeeded at capitalism. Let's get something else out there, please.
Right. Well, don't look at DC publishing.
Okay. So crush my dreams. Go ahead.
So the reason I bring this up is there's an odd entry into this sort of source book thing. So DC Comics is releasing a 40-page special, which they're calling a source book, that is focused on bringing the world of The Last God, which I'm not familiar with, but it's a fantasy set series that's only, I think, published like 3 issues. So it's got maybe a total of like 100 pages of actual comics.
Okay.
But they're releasing a source book of this. And I think that what they saw is that it's compatible enough with a kind of traditional fantasy setting, like elves and dwarves and everything, that you can kind of take the playable races, subclasses, and monsters and magic items and kind of overwrite them.
Okay, so just like reskin them a bit. Tweak them a bit. Okay.
Basically, these are goblins, these are elves. They're publishing this as a source book and letting you play in this world. And
it's for D&D, right? Yeah. Just to clarify.
Okay. They're saying it's most compatible with D&D, but basically it could be a source book for anything.
Is it going to be system neutral?
No, the basic thing that they said is it is made for 5e.
Okay.
I think
okay.
Essentially.
Compatible with the world's most popular role-playing
yes,
game.
Yes, yes.
Pardon me where I gag myself with a spoon. All right.
So they're making it for that. And that made me realize, like, anybody that wanted to play in this world probably is already playing in this world. They've done it themselves. And so I guess having it from the official writers and stuff, they can flesh stuff out that is,
right.
That's exactly what they intended. But it's too bad that we're losing the inspiration of, yeah, I want to do this. Let's make this and see how it is to play in this. Let's see what system would fit this the most and how that goes together. Yeah, so people now are just, and a lot of people are, I guess, seeing the opportunity. Well, this is a fantasy setting. It's popular. So here's a source book to play in it.
Like, as someone who wants to make role-playing games and has made a couple of very small ones, I understand why big companies would use Dungeons & Dragons as a vehicle to get the rules, because it's the most popular role-playing game out there, which is also the reason why I don't give people crap for making things for Dungeons & Dragons. I mean, like, right. You kind of want to get your foot in the door. You want to get noticed. Hey, that's going to be your widest audience.
Right.
So why not exploit that? But it also is kind of disappointing where it's like, you could do this in another system. And as someone who says system matters, yeah, it's a little sad to me that you're not finding what is the best system for your game, possibly.
Yeah, that's something that I think, companies that own big IPs, you know, like Hasbro, you know, is very guilty of this, is trying to figure out ways to, you know, there's a Warhammer 40K Monopoly game. You know, it's just like, they're just trying to match things up because people see a logo and be like, I like that.
Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
Please tell me, like, the Emperor's Throne Room or Terra is Boardwalk.
I hope so.
Because if it isn't, what's the point?
Right. Yeah, I haven't seen the properties, but I've seen the box cover. Like, wow. Yeah, when they released 8th edition, that was one of the licensed products that came out with that. It reminds me of kind of what happened with video games, and companies realize that there's money to be made by doing a Tiny Toons or, you know, any movie property. They have a tie-in.
Way to be a 90s kid.
They have a tie-in, you know, video game, and it's just cranked out and it's just garbage. And so now that they're seeing popularity in tabletop, you know, board games and role-playing games, these big companies with big IPs are like, so how can we? And they're taking a garbage system or something just not even well thought out in like a board game, like the mechanics that are just rolled to move. You know, just like in the 70s and 80s, you know, like there's a King Kong board game and just all this stuff where it's like, okay, I guess you were playing in that world. Yeah. But
note to self, Warhammer 40,000 Candyland. Okay, go ahead.
Where the colors represent the gods and chaos gods.
Good, yeah.
I think that's a real danger. And of as the industry is growing, it's not growing. It's not anywhere near like what video games are.
Right.
But as it's growing, those companies are going to start to get involved. And then you're going to have that pollution. Because I always think that when you see, well, here's
how you really feel about these names.
here's the library. The library of everything that was published for, you know, a certain video game system. And 50% of it is just licensed garbage that nobody, you know, should have ever played, but it got kids to, you know, get their grandmothers to.
But really, isn't that kind of, I mean, you want to be real cynical about it. Aren't these products just kind of a vehicle for the company to siphon up people's money?
And to do it with recognizable. And it's just, I hate the marketing speak. I copied a little bit of an article that has a lot of that marketing speak about, you know, your involvement in the IP and how to, you know, and just it's so
ugly. Parasocial relationship. You have no involvement with the IP.
Right. Yeah, the way that they term this and the way that they, you know, like we're trying to broaden and, you know, moving into different media, and just it's just nauseating. So I was surprised, like indie comics publishers like Oni Press have a game division now. So they're publishing, you know, games based on their most popular properties, and they're cautiously moving into it. But and I guess that's good for the independent press world. But they're going to be just completely overshadowed once Hasbro decides exactly how they want to what they want to buy and how they want to crank that up for the tabletop. But yeah, that whole thing was just depressing, and it reminded me of how far, especially the RPG hobby, is getting from that original, like, what do you want to do? What world do you want to see? You want a world with no elves? Excellent. Let's do that. You know, the things that allow people to really give them exactly the kind of adventure that they want. And it's just too bad. We're now moving into this, like, oh, which license do you want to
play in?
And
I mean, I understand the appeal of playing in a licensed kind of setting. I also understand the appeal of playing characters, established characters in that setting, especially more if the show is episodic. So, I mean, I'm a big fan of Steven Universe or other kind of stuff, and I've said, hey, this would be a great game, and because that show is episodic, you could hand out those exact characters and not kind of mess up, air quotes, whatever happened in the show because, hey, this happened during episode whatever. Mm-hmm. Or like Seinfeld. You know, that's the other classic one where like these things don't really link together, so we can just kind of play whatever. Mm-hmm. So I understand the appeal there, but I also, yeah, kind of want to play in your own setting where you're not locked down. Or at least for me, part of the reason I don't do historical stuff and part of the reason I was surprised that I like the Alien franchise or the Alien RPG game is for franchise or existing IP stuff, I tend to get way bogged down in making sure whatever I come up with fits mm-hmm. in that established mm-hmm. thing. I often throw out a lot of stuff and I don't like, I've come to the point where I don't like doing that and realize the best way for me to not do that is to not use IP. Right. Because then I don't have to worry about it. Mm-hmm. At all. Mm-hmm. I'm just like, no, this is, I cut this from whole cloth.
Yeah.
But I also understand pulling bits and pieces mm-hmm. Because it's hard to come up with stuff whole cloth. I mean, that right. blank page problem. Mm-hmm. You're just looking at, what am I going to do? I don't know. So, yeah, totally borrow from other existing stuff.
Yeah, I think the RPG community has always, yeah, done that stuff that's really inspired you. Like, yeah, let's see how we can do this. Mm-hmm. Or can I make a character like this in whatever system we're playing.
I have less problem with that. Can I make a character like this in a system mm-hmm. rather than the here's in this sitting or in this right. system, right? Where I'm just like, make a character, okay, don't make actual Wolverine, make a character like Wolverine, you know, call it like Honey Badger or whatever, you know?
Yeah. He's even more ferocious.
Yeah, really.
I think that's going to keep coming up. And I think, yeah, Alien is probably the best example of an IP handled well that was paired with a good system that, yeah, was enjoyable.
I agree with you. There's mm-hmm. a caveat. We haven't seen a lot of stuff come out mm-hmm. for it yet. We still only have the source yeah, book.
Right.
So I hope it wouldn't happen, but there's still a chance for that to happen. And you kind of go, oh, this isn't really what I'm
yeah.
Really,
yeah, I think we're all kind of, yeah, to see their first campaign setting, everyone's, yeah, maybe holding
yeah, yeah,
their
I really
want to
see
that bit.
First campaign setting. So on a positive note, since I often talk a lot about how I don't like a specific large game that mm-hmm. I feel is overshadowing stuff, I've decided to try and talk about games that I do think are cool.
Good.
And the first one I found is Escape from Dino Island by Sam Tung and Sam Roberts. And as you can probably imagine, it's Jurassic Park.
Mm-hmm.
It's a $10, 36-page, very nicely illustrated PDF on itch.io. It's intended for kind of one shots or one session, but you could do like two sessions out of it. Mm. And the reason they said it's for one shots is it does something very specific. It's you're on Dinosaur Island. Your goal is to get off. So like however many sessions that takes, that's kind of it. That's the campaign arc. So you're not going to go, oh, well, I suppose you could do Jurassic Park 2 and then do, oh, hey, dinosaurs escape from the island too. I think it's really nicely set up where the first couple pages of the book are a series of questions that you answer as a group, like why are you here, mm-hmm. you know, what's your goal, mm-hmm. what did you hear about dinosaurs and all this stuff. So while it's inspired by Jurassic Park, there are a lot of options that kind of then make it something different. And then in the Game Master section, there's bits about, hey, here's kind of like the answers, here's possible answers to the mysteries that the characters are looking into. Mm-hmm. Like maybe they're actually animatronic dinosaurs, you know, and stuff mm-hmm. like that. I think this was a great example of an low cost, because mm-hmm. that's the other thing, like people talking about, hey, can't do multiple systems because it's too expensive. And mm-hmm. my answer is that's bullshit. You're just not looking in the right places. Here's an example of a low cost game that looks pretty awesome,
mm-hmm.
you know, and like I buy stuff on itch.io all the time, and I was really surprised at the quality of the illustrations in this for $10.
Yeah, nice. Yeah.
I mean, you're not going to get something that's like a $50 like PHB on itch.io by independent
right.
people, but this is still awesome, and you should absolutely check it out. My feeling is there's no excuse to say you don't have enough money to mm-hmm. try a new system.
Mm.
Especially given the number of low-cost, free, pay what you want, and now community copies mm-hmm. that people are putting on itch. So stop playing that other game. I mean, unless you don't want to, unless you're actually enjoying it. Stop playing that other game only because you're broke
mm-hmm.
and go pick up something else.
Excellent. My only question is,
sure.
is it compatible with the Tamer universe?
You know what? I was also trying to not bring that up, but after I looked at this game, I said, huh. If I was ever going to do a quasi-serious game about that horrible book, this would be it.
Nice.
Because there's already dinosaurs. There's, you know, there's a nice system in place. Oh, it's powered by the apocalypse as well, which
I really like.
So to answer your question, yes, though I don't particularly want to make that game.
Right, of course. Just teasing. Oh, one quick thing on Kickstarter.
Ooh.
There's another one of those big getting millions of dollars and a lot of attention. Did you ever play the board game Dark Tower?
I did not.
Okay. It's back. And they're saying the coolest... Oh, sorry.
So I can play it now.
You can? Well, kind of.
Oh. Yeah. Okay, tell me more.
Yeah, the coolest game ever to hit the planet that first appeared 35 years ago, featuring an electronic tower in the middle. You know, it had music and it told you what was going on.
Okay.
Well, it's back. But they overcomplicated it to this... like ridiculous extent. So it was very fun because it had a fantasy setting and there's this big tower in the middle. I think like even like Orson Welles or somebody did the commercial It, did the voiceover for the commercial. But it's basically you're just trying to siege this tower. You've got this army and it's kind of like a race to conquer the Dark Tower. Right. The little computer in the tower told you like when you attack, how many troops you lose, how many food you have left, and you just kept track of it on a little pegboard. And now they're turning it into more of a cooperative game. It has a corruption mechanic.
Okay.
So the tower's constantly spilling skulls on different player sides of the board.
Okay.
And they have to distribute this corruption amongst their little areas and castles and settlements. And I don't know, it looks way overly complicated because you pick a character and you have powers and abilities. And it's combining kind of the newer trends of board games with this old idea. And it's really expensive. It's like $150.
Yikes!
And with the other miniatures and things that they include, it's like $225, you know, plus shipping. So you're looking at
Japan, it might as well be an even $300. Yeah,
right. There's a lot of people behind it. They say, you know, 3 years in development, and they involve some good game designers to kind of give them ideas, and it's got nice artwork, but I'm really worried if it's one of those like kind of pump up a game that's not really gonna, you know, be very satisfying, and then just, you know, it's a nostalgia grab. And
that's what it is. It's a nostalgia grab, and if people played that original game 35 years ago and enjoyed it, more power to them. But I mean, really, if you're familiar with that game, you probably know roughly what you're going to get into with this one.
Yeah, well, it seems like they've got, it's the name, but I'm not sure the whole spirit of it. Yeah, it's got the same like cosmetic look. Right. There's a big plastic tower in the middle of a round board. And then other than that, I'm not sure if the mechanics like really stuck in there. I was hoping to see if you had played that.
I have not. Yeah. What you're telling me is I should get a team together and redo Mall Madness. The thing with the electronic mall.
Yes, exactly.
In the center of the shopping mall board game. Right. Yeah, okay.
But make it very complicated with character classes.
That also spits skulls and has corruption. Yeah, okay. Corrupted Mall of Madness. All right, yeah. Anyone want to help? Yeah. Just send me an email.
Yeah, so if you have any opinions about this Kickstarter, let us know in the comments. I'm very suspicious of it. I mean, it's drawing me in and it's gorgeous looking. And the tower itself is very complicated. Although they haven't shown you a consistent, like, representation of like what it's going to look like. It looks kind of short and fat.
Oh, okay.
And but in the original promotion, it had that same silhouette as the original tower, which is quite tall, like, you know, more than a foot tall. But maybe that's why all the original ones, the motor is broken in them.
They turned
it around because it was too big. It wasn't built to last. Would love to recreate that experience, but I don't know if you can anymore. Yeah.
You can't go back. Yeah. I've learned that. You can't go back. Don't even try. I mean, just try and make something new out of the experience you wanted to have.
Right. Where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter, as always, where I am not talking about the world's greatest role-playing game. That's HiveMind, HyveMynd. And that's basically it.
Excellent. If you'd like to get in touch with Idle Red Hands, the website is idleredhands.com. You can follow us on Twitter at Idle Red Hands and Instagram. And also check out our YouTube channel and our Twitch. And if you'd like to support the podcast, please visit patreon.com/idleredhands. And so that's it for this week. We'll be back next week. Bye.
Later, mortals.